You don't have to rise. The Senate Revenue Committee will come to order. If we could have our members. Today we're looking into local options on school funding. You're going to have to bear with me. I am battling a cold, so the vice chair might at some point take my duties. But the purpose of this meeting is it's the first in about a week-long process that we will undertake on the Senate Revenue Committee to start looking at what local options might be out there and other school finance issues. And this is the first step this afternoon that we will take, and this will be on our agenda. And committee members, as you look at your week at a glance, you'll notice that this is scheduled. These issues are scheduled for next week as well. So we're hoping to move fast and judiciously, but produce a product relatively quickly on school funding issues. Our first witnesses that we will bring up on SJR 18 is Senator Ringo and Representative Mark Hass.
You want to say anything, Ted?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to see such a full committee available today.
We need you.
I really appreciate your hearing.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferriol.
Philip White. I'd like
to. I really appreciate your hearing this resolution. Our schools are in very deep trouble. We've slashed programs. We've cut class days. We're making class sizes way too big. Just last weekend up in Beaverton, I ran into a school parent who just said, Charlie, parents are leaving the schools in droves. They're looking for other alternatives, and I think it bodes ill for the future of our public education system when we lose the critical mass of support from our citizens. When we don't adequately fund schools, of course, we do a great disservice to our children, but we also place at risk the future prosperity of our state. For decades, one of the factors that brought businesses to Oregon was our strong public education system. So not only are we doing a disservice to our children, we are going to look at continuing hard times for our economy. Now, ever since this legislative session began, I know a lot of us have looked at a lot of potential revenue options, whether it's a sales tax or a gross receipts tax or a business activity tax, and there's lots of things that deserve study, but I'm convinced that one piece of the solution has to be to allow communities a greater ability to fund their schools. I mean, local option funding is not the complete solution, but it's an important step in the right direction. And I want to take a moment and address a potential concern with local option, and that's the argument that it's inconsistent with the concept of school equalization. There's no question that every child in every corner of Oregon deserves a quality education, and I would expect that the state would provide funding for that quality education for all Oregon children. But it doesn't make sense to me for our state to impose a ceiling or an upper limit on what a school may achieve. Our state needs to recognize that different communities have different values and different needs. Some communities may value education more than other communities and are perfectly willing to raise their own taxes for better schools. The voters of Corvallis and Portland, for example, voted in favor of Measure 28, partly because they were willing to pay more taxes for schools. It seems extremely unfair to me that those communities are prevented from having a certain quality of schools because of the way people in other communities may vote. Now, there's another benefit to local option that I'd just like to mention, and that is one of the unfortunate aspects of Measure 5 was that we transferred the bulk of the funding for our schools away from the community to the state. And with that went local accountability and local control. And that's a good reason to move back towards local funding, is to increase the amount of local control over our schools. Representative Hass and I, together with others, have introduced SJR 18, and there are a number of other people that are pushing local option. And I don't suggest that SJR 18 is the only way to go, or maybe even the best way to go. But I think it's an important discussion to have, and I welcome a broader discussion as to the pros and cons of different ways to go on local option. I do want to point out to you, Mr. Chair, and to the citizens in this room that Measure 18, as it's currently written, would just raise the Measure 5 limit from $5 to $7 per thousand. There's some Dash 1 amendments that I think are over there dramatically change the nature of the resolution so that instead of just raising the Measure 5 cap, if we did that, we'd still have Measure 50 issues, state funding formula issues. And I think when we talk about local control, it's better to put all of that outside the Measure 5, 50 constraints and statutory constraints. And so I would encourage everybody to look at the Dash 1 amendments that would change the nature of the resolution. I'm absolutely convinced that local funding is critical for our schools, and I really hope that the legislature can get behind supporting that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. President Haas.
Thank you, Committee. Mark Haas, House District 27, for the record. Let me begin by explaining what this measure is not. It is not a long-term solution to the way we fund education. It is not a tax overhaul that reduces our unhealthy over-reliance on the income tax. It's simply an option we can offer local school districts who are asking for help. I see these people we've asked to run our schools standing a little bit like they're in a flood zone, up on the rooftop waving white flags pleading for help, and we can't ignore those pleas. I want to echo some of the very same sentiments of Senator Ringo, and I meet with these very same parents, and I'm sorry, but I just can't go to these parents and tell them we can't help you right now, that we must fix this broken down retirement system that we have, and then regain trust from voters, and then maybe in 2, 3, or 4 years we can get around to working on education. That excuse just doesn't wash. And what's more, I think we can regain the trust from citizens in this state if we responsibly address the shortcomings in our school funding system. I know that equity and equalization is an issue here. In our last session, 2001, we were told and congratulated because we finally reached full equalization. In other words, all school districts receive equal educational, all school students receive equal educational resources. This measure doesn't take anything away from that floor of equalization. It simply allows districts, if they choose, to build on that floor. In addition, I'm hopeful that we can provide substantial financial incentives to so-called property poor districts to pass local options if they so choose. One way to do that is to divert federal timber receipts into Oregon's Local Option Equalization Fund. An amendment has been drafted to SB 747 to do this. And this is important because we'll never achieve a long-term solution until we have all of Oregon working together. And I think this measure is one positive step down that road. Ultimately, we need to stay focused on a long-term solution to bring quality education to all corners of this state, but we'll never get there until we have everybody working together for that goal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Corcoran, welcome. We have moved the school finance bills out.
I understand.
So we're now on the assessor bill.
That's right. South Lane is doing really well, I understand, in this whole thing. Yeah. Thank you very much.
State Treasurer Randall Edwards.
Mr. Chairman, I had questions for those two gentlemen.
You're not off the hook, Ringo.
I think these gentlemen...
What's that?
Got questions. Senator Ferrioli has questions for you. Grab Haas. David, grab Haas.
Senator Ferrioli.
Mr. Chairman, I have been looking at this concept and thinking about this concept and have discussed this concept with the proponents of the concept, and I just wanted to make a couple observations of it. First of all, we have compared communities by values, and we've compared community by needs. I think we also need to think about comparison of communities by capacity. And I just want to really make it very clear that there seems to be a discussion in Oregon about whether or not communities equally value education of their children, and that is reflected by their relative commitment to measures that may appear on the ballot or school support local initiatives. I just want to point out that I think most of the communities that I represent certainly value their schools as highly as any. And if there's any question about that, you could look back at the record at Measure 5, for instance, Mr. Chairman. So when we talk about value and need, I think it would be helpful if folks accorded others in Oregon the same sense of value and the same recognition of need, that there is a real difference in capacity. per capita incomes in rural areas are half what they are in urban areas. And I think that really limits people's capacity to do the kinds of things that many of them would like to do. I think we should remember that what's driving the whole question of equalization funding formulas is equity, not justice. And equity is a legal term. It has to do with how you spend your money and whether that's legal or not and whether that's constitutionally approvable or not. The other thing I think we need to talk about is local option. Local option for some people have one definition. For others, it's different. Local option is the ability of a community to raise its own tax base for schools above their constitutional limits or if they're not under compression. We have that in Ashland. We have it in Eugene. What I think this legislation brings is more than local option. It's local initiative. Different communities are going to try to find different initiatives to try to solve this problem. And I think we ought to be as flexible as we can about bringing those proposals to the table, listening very carefully to what the local communities define as their local initiatives. They will take different configurations in different communities because capacities differ. I think we should be willing, at least in the short term, to think about these temporary solutions as being something that we can use and need. Because these are short-term solutions, I think we also need to look ahead to a day when, and I hope I live to see it legislatively, that we've solved the PERS problem. We've reestablished some credibility in the state government. We have been able to successfully agree on a restructuring of our state funding mechanisms for schools, including incorporation of more than just a notion of a full and adequate funding by reporting to the legislature once a year why we're not funding the quality education model and noting that the gap as it grows from what we can actually fund to what the model says we should be funding, to a day when we have agreed on restructuring and fully funded education. And I think on that day we probably do refer and return back to the equalization funding formula. But that day is in the future. In the meantime, the dialogue has been stimulating, and I've enjoyed that interaction with my colleagues on bringing this whole issue of the funding formula and how that reflects the different capacities of the state of Oregon. So I appreciate these gentlemen for bringing this initiative and their amendments.
That was your question?
Mr. Chair.
That was my question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Sarah Ferrioli, I wouldn't disagree with anything that you've said, and I would be as critical as you are of anyone who would question someone's sincerity about education in southern Oregon versus eastern Oregon versus the suburbs or anywhere else. The sad thing is that we do have a system that does sometimes put people pitched against each other, and that is the problem that we're all, I think, working together to try to address.
And now to my question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ferrioli.
Would it not increase the credibility of this approach if we added a sunset date? I mean, I'm hoping that we see within 2 to 3 years the solution of PERS, the resolution of the question of tax structure in Oregon, the adequacy of school funding. And if those are the goals that we have and we recognize we have a near-term shortfall, wouldn't it be a reasonable thing to, say, put a 2 or 4 year sunset on this new capacity, pointing out that we will someday come back to a system that is equalized, that is under an equalization formula?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I guess I would like to think that I believe there's general agreement that schools were managed better when there was more local funding because there was a greater sense of accountability and control. And that when the education dollars are routed through the big bureaucracy in Salem, people just don't feel as good about funding their schools as when they know that if they vote for a funding levy, it's going to go to the neighborhood school, and they know the school board member that's going to be making the critical decisions as to how that's going to be spent. And so I think that's part of the discussion here is, do we want our schools to be funded mostly from Salem, or do we want our schools to be funded more from the local property tax base? Obviously, when you say local, that raises inequity issues, and that's where I think we've got to make sure that there's enough state dollars so that every child gets a good basic level quality of education. But I do think that it would be the long-term improvement for all the schools in Oregon to return more to a local funding system.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess the in concept, I absolutely agree with you. In one of our counties, 95% of the property is not on the tax roll. And I think if you asked Senator Dukes to talk to you about what capacity their community has to levy taxes, and that's closer to 98% of their...
That's right. And that's why the state needs to provide adequate dollars to provide a basic level for her area, your area, you know, everywhere that doesn't have a strong property tax base.
Right. And then at the other end of the spectrum, population-wise, Wheeler County has 2,000 residents.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are different capacities. And I just wanted to remind us that we need to move forward. We need to solve some systemic and structural problems. At the end of the day, there's still going to be very significant disparate capacities in our communities.
Well, I'm going to cut it off there because we have a long list of folks to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Treasurer Randall Edwards, Representative Shetterly, Senator Morse, if he's here. Senator Morse, come on up.
I don't like it when Representative Shetterly is carrying a whole bunch of paper. It makes me nervous.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, members. My name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I really appreciate the fact that you're holding a hearing now on something that I think is extremely important for the state to discuss, and that is improving local control of schools and their finances. Specifically, local school districts should be given the ability to ask their local communities for more help in running their schools, and if there's any time we could be witnessing this, it is now. As we look across the state and see a number of school districts currently lopping off school days, and if they're not doing it now, they're going to be doing it next fall. And given the revenue forecast of last Friday, there is not going to be a lifeline from this state to help schools in the next year or two. So I think the timing of a discussion about how much should a local community be able to ask and be supported from its voters is extremely important. And I think the time is now to begin this, and I commend you, Mr. Chair, and the members to have this discussion now. Representative Shetterly and I have been discussing with you and others about a local option, and what we would like to do is present just a framework which is a little different but similar to what is presented in this bill. And again, I think as Senator Ringo said, this is a starting point, not an ending point, but I think that's the important part here. Again, what's critical for Oregon right now, in my opinion, is that the school system of this state is not only broke, but broken. And we, as a community, both at large with the state and at the local level, need to address what has happened as a result of what happened from the passage of ballot measure 5 and 50. One unintended consequence that I believe if you go around the state and ask communities was that now the control of the destiny of a local school district, as was described in the previous panel, is now here in the capital. And that loss of local control, I think, is something that resonates across Oregon. It's not a partisan issue. It's not an urban-rural issue. This is an issue of how well should schools be connected to the local communities. The system we have today has totally disconnected the community from their schools. Given the financial situation of Oregon, as I described earlier, we do not see in the immediate future an ability for the state to help school districts starting next fall. And I think that's another critical point for us to be looking at. As we witnessed this year, schools had to wait until late of January, to figure out whether or not voters were going to approve a ballot measure to help school districts. And even still, schools continue to cut as a result of that failure. And that, of course, was asked of voters at a time when schools had already been well into the school year. We're getting national recognition about how we're funding our schools. Doonesbury certainly has been hitting many points about how Oregon is faring under this economic recession. And again, we have got to look at the long term, that looking back in time, ballot measure 5 and measure 50 have set a course for our public schools that I don't think is sustainable. It's broke, it's broken, and it's incumbent upon all of us, whether you're a state elected official, a representative, a local elected official, school boards, school districts, have got to get in front of the curve and try to help at both a short-term and a long-term solution for our public schools. This is the first step, and I appreciate your taking this testimony.
Yeah. Questions?
Language, aren't there?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to be with you this afternoon. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23. And, gosh, it's impressive to see what happens when you have a revenue committee meeting in the afternoon.
People are up.
Yeah, people are up.
And I think it has more to do with the personalities of the chairs.
So. Thank you. Thank you, Senator. In respect of the folks who are here, I will be brief today. I think you've heard a lot of the policy, I think, that is bringing us to what you have presented in SJR 18 today. And on a technical side, I think, you know, we do have right now a local option available for schools, but there are serious constraints that limit its utility to the schools that have gone out for it. One is the Measure 5 cap. That is, they are limited to schools are limited in what they can raise under the local option to the gap in funding between the Measure 50 limit and the current Measure 5 limit. That has limited the dollar amount, and it also makes it technically complicated for districts to even begin to calculate what they can raise with a local option, because until they run the rolls, those per property gap calculations aren't made and districts don't know. And then that amount changes, of course, from year to year as the gap changes over the life of a levy. So you've got the Measure 5 constraint and the Measure 50 constraint that limits the utility of the local option that's available to schools now. You also have in statute a statutory constraint that limits the local option to $500 per student, or 10% of the state school fund distribution to each community. Some communities that aren't constrained by the Measure 5 limit are, in fact, constrained by this current statutory limitation. And Treasurer Edwards and I have developed over the past few weeks a proposal that would deal with both of those, number one being a constitutional referral similar to what it sounds like the -1 amendments may be with SJR 18, to refer out an amendment to the Constitution to allow school districts to levy a local option property tax up to $2 per thousand outside of the Measure 5 limits. So there we deal with that Measure 5 constraint. Statutorily, we propose an adjustment to the per student cap, increasing that to $1,000 per student, or 20% of the state school fund distribution to the district. So we basically create an opportunity for more revenue inside this local option. Equity is a big issue, and I think it's hard to define, but we don't want to leave it behind. And I want to underscore that we have already available to us a mechanism to deal substantially with the equity issue, because the truth is some districts are substantially more property rich than others and can have a much more substantial property tax base and can get more out of their local option. In the 2001 session, we created and funded the Local Option Equalization Fund. And it seems to me that in the last, Paul knows, in Maz and May, but it seems to me in the last 2 years, three districts availed themselves of that. Pendleton was one, and Colton was another, and I forget the third. And the way that works, and it's in law right now, the way it works is that districts that are below the 75th percentile of districts statewide in terms of their tax base have the ability to draw money out of this local option equalization fund if they put forward the local effort of passing their own local option initiative. So in that way, part of our effort would be to see that school fund dollars are placed into that option equalization fund so that districts that are more rural, and not always just rural, David Douglas is in the same boat, I think, but have the poorer property tax base, would have the ability then to draw on that to realize a more equivalent benefit from their own local option levy. All those things, I think, really do have the makings of reinvigorating that sense of local control, and with that accountability that we lost with Measure 5. I think if you think of it as a pendulum, before Measure 5 we had a gross over-reliance on the property tax base, 70% property tax, 30% state school support. On the passage of Measure 5 and the roll in, that pendulum swung just opposite to 30% local and 70% state support without any new revenue to the state to fulfill that obligation. I think what the proposal we're talking about here today with your -1 amendments, or what the Treasurer and I have suggested, is a way to rebalance that funding level between state and local And to that extent, I think that's all to the good. It does bring communities back into conversation with their schools and schools back into conversation with their communities in only the way that dollars can bring them. I think there are districts out there that are just anxious for us to take action to give them the opportunity to do this. Speaking of that, of course, as we know, the increase, the $2 per thousand local option authority would have to be a constitutional amendment, as you have before USGR 18, so that you're aware of the timing. If we want to make this money available for school districts next fall, we need to have this out on the statewide ballot by June 10. That is the last date on which this measure could be considered. Backing up from that, the last date that we could get this out of the building if we want to do an explanatory statement and voters pamphlet would be April 11th. So there is our time frame for looking at this to get this out of the building. I'll close just by referring to an unsolicited email that I received this morning. It was on my desk when I got in today from the superintendent of the Condon School District. He was in to see me a couple of weeks ago, and we just kind of talked about this in general. And I think he was had with him the superintendent of the Fossil District. I don't know his name, but this is from Superintendent Ted Thonstad of Condon. And his email to me says, "There is no doubt that we need stable funding for education in Oregon, and there should be a formula that provides equity. The question is equity of funding or equity of services. However, in the meantime, small rural districts with declining enrollment need the opportunity to determine what kind of schools they want. The current local option either does not allow districts to raise enough money or does not provide a stable funding stream because of compression. Your proposal would allow local communities to make their own decision. I hope you will continue to pursue this effort despite the opposition." What? Opposition? In talking to several fellow superintendents in rural districts, I believe they would testify in favor of such legislation. I think in this we have an opportunity to heal some of the rift between rural and urban by providing districts across the state the substantially equivalent and equitable opportunities to raise their local dollars to invest in their own local schools, and especially then recognizing the role of the Equalization Fund, where the state can supplement those districts that do not have the wealth and property tax base that some have. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate your consideration of this. I think it's hugely important, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, I will excuse myself. I've got a Judiciary Committee upstairs. Thank you.
Say hello to your parole officer.
you're dodging the tough questions, I suppose, going to leave them to me. Mr. Chairman, my name is Frank Morris, members of the committee. I represent the school districts of Albany, Corvallis, and Philomath. Senator Ringo was most kind in offering an opportunity to sign on to this bill when he was submitting it. And at that time, I chose not to because I was concerned about the very things that Senator Farioli has been addressing, is how do we maintain equalization? And I didn't think the bill addressed that. When looking at the amendments that are being proposed today by Representative Shetterly and Treasurer Edwards, I believe this bill is good public policy. I believe it provides local districts a lifeline. And certainly we need it, and that's something that I hear very loud and clear from the districts that I represent. And I believe that we have the opportunity to amend this bill to provide equalization. You know, since Measure 5, I think we have transitioned from a position of districts earning their right for increased funding to a sense of entitlement that happens to come from the state. And I think this does restore that opportunity for local districts. And I don't think that it creates an undue differential between districts. For example, in meeting last night with the Corvallis business manager and a group of coalition advocates for education, if this was exercised within the Corvallis district, it would raise approximately $7 million. It would change that funding formula between local and state, as referenced by Representative Shetterly, from the 70-30 formula to approximately 60-40. I don't think that represents an undue differential. The policy question I think coming before us, and as I've sensed this issue in talking to a number of folks through our office, is what is the best vehicle to provide adequate and stable funding for education? And there are some of those that think that it's the bigger picture that we need to be addressing, a more comprehensive solution. And that's certainly true. But there are those that think that at this time a partial solution is the best approach. And I would give you some reflections as my membership on the Joint Ways and Means Committee has provided some, I believe, insights on this issue. It's clear that statewide revenue increases are not in the cards. That will not happen. Just pragmatically, that is not going to happen. Not supported by the public, as witnessed by Measure 28, and our governor has made it very clear that that's not going to be his agenda this year. And the issue of major revenue restructuring, I don't sense in this assembly a groundswell of support to look at major restructuring of our revenue codes. Our economy is not improving, and the revenue forecasts that we are receiving now, they're not even sufficient to support the governor's balanced budget. That's very clear. The March revenue forecast is approximately $500 million below what was used in the governor's balanced budget forecast. And when you factor in the need for a reserve balance, which the governor's budget has a de minimis ending reserve of 0.2%, the Department of Revenue is suggesting that we use an ending balance of somewhere between 4% and 7%. So you factor these things in, and of course it's unknown what our ending balance is going to be in 03, but you factor in the potential for a flat revenue projection on May 15th with the need for a reasonable ending balance, and we're looking at potential reductions within our general fund budget of approximately anywhere from $700 to could be upwards of $900 million. And I think we're all aware of that. But what it does, it just points out, I think, the need to address a local option. When I hear teachers pleading with 45 students in their fifth grade teachers with 45 students in their classroom, one of whom is an autistic student, that is not quality education. And these districts are needing help. And I believe that this this local funding option is one that would be helpful. I've included in the information I submitted to you an analysis. I suspect many of you have seen this. It's called Selected Winners and Losers Under Oregon's Post-Measure 5 State School Fund Distribution Formula. And the reason that I point this out is that I don't think that the funding distribution within our state is proportional to needs. If you look at, for example, Three Rivers in, I'm not sure where Three Rivers is, but for example, take Baker. And this is not a criticism of Baker, but they have had on an adjusted, inflation-adjusted basis an increase of 19.4%. Whereas, for example, the district I represent in Corvallis has had an inflation-adjusted decrease of 12.1%. And I don't think that the funding formula is proportional. And this would provide an opportunity. This local funding option would provide that opportunity. So we have some major policy questions. Is this current state school fund distribution formula proportional to the needs of all districts? I don't believe it is. I don't believe that the record shows that. Should a school district be allowed to increase funding outside the state school fund distribution formula? Should a school district that supports schools be penalized first by school districts that don't? And I would suggest to you that the existing formula is not proportional to the needs, and I believe that school districts should be able to fund their individual needs, provided there is an equalization opportunity, as proposed by Treasurer Edwards and Representative Shetterly. SJR 18 is a vehicle to make these amendments and address the need for equalization. Clearly, this does not force any tax increases, but it provides local school advocates the opportunity to improve their schools. And this is desperately needed. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, Senator, I disagree with your analysis that there would be no impetus for a statewide resolution to the crisis that we have in adequacy. And I've been really struggling with this because I have the third largest school district in the state in my Senate district, and I also have about 14 of the smallest and poorest. And I can't for the life of me see how this does anything for anyone but the wealthiest parts of the state. I'm not finding that. So I guess my question to you would be, if you gave 198 school districts the capacity to increase their level by $2, how many do you think would be able to successfully pass such an effort?
Well, that's a question that's very difficult to answer, Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran. You know, it's an issue of fairness for those districts that would not support. Should they hold down those districts that would support? And you know, that's a hard question to answer. I truly believe that those districts, for example, the Corvallis community passed Measure 28 quite convincingly, and they're a community that's really committed to their schools. Should they be denied that opportunity? As I understand Representative Sherrilly's proposal, those school districts that do pass the local option but don't have they're not blessed with the property tax basis that a more rich district would have, they would then have the opportunity to come back and realize an equalization through the state so that if they're supporting their schools, they could be maintained on an equal basis to those districts that do have a higher tax base locally. So I think the opportunity is there for the education community to reach out and develop that support, and they've lost that. Measure 5 destroyed that. And I think this restores their opportunity to go out and earn the public's trust and the public's commitment to quality education.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
But my difficulty still is, you know, you'll get a bunch of nodding heads behind you when you say, why should those school districts that want to increase the adequacy of their education be held down by those that won't do that? And I would question whether it's won't or can't. I don't know that Oak Ridge will ever be able to do that, no matter what the willingness is in that community, because of the demographics, because of property values, because of geographic location. And, you know, that's just what I'm struggling with. I mean, I'm not being critical. I'm just my view is that if we were really serious about adequacy in school funding, that we would look at a statewide, you know, 1% increase in the, you know, and just do it that way rather than leaving, you know, creating a greater and greater gap in the equity issues. So that's the problem I have.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I would be here in full commitment to some kind of statewide solution to this issue. But absent that, and we're kind of, it's an issue of probability. What stands the greatest chance of succeeding in this assembly? And I would suggest that this local option stands a better opportunity than does a major restructuring effort. You know, we need to look at that. But to me, it's just a matter of where are the chances the best of achieving improvement in funding for education.
Well, unfortunately, I would submit that given our behavior in the last five special sessions, we took the worst way to do things seriously and just did it and did it and did it, and now we're in a hell of a mess. So I'm not quite sure if that's the answer either, but we'll see.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Morse. Next up, Representative Krummel, Jim Scherzinger. Jim, are you here? Superintendent. And Deborah, Representative Kafori.
We can put the superintendent between us, Deborah. Might a peacemaker.
No, you don't have to be there.
Go ahead, Representative Primmel.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Jerry Krimmel from House District 26. I understand that you're sort of kicking around some ideas here, and I've listened to the conversation so far. And what I'm going to do is a little bit different than come up and talk about the virtues of the present bill, but rather since you are talking about some ideas, I'm going to throw an idea out on the table. And do with it what you will. I think it's a pretty good idea, and this idea was actually brought to me by a constituent from the Forest Grove area. He had done some research, and one of the things that he looked at was the Iowa model of how they fund their schools in Iowa. And after looking at the material that he sent and looking at some other materials, I thought, well, we could sort of organize this the Iowa plan. And so I'd like to just put this idea before you, and I apologize for not having a handout that would have that has bullet points and everything, but I since our conversation last evening I didn't have a chance to put anything together, but I will put something together and then make sure that everybody in the body, both the House and the Senate, are able to get copies of it. And what I would prefer that we do is, opposed to taking another short-term look at our school funding, I would rather take kind of a long view. And I think that the plan that I'm going to present you with, or the package, if you will, that I'm going to present you with, really will really does take a long view as opposed to a short view. And it really is kind of a package approach as opposed to a piecemeal approach. And I think one of the things that we managed to have gotten ourselves in trouble with in Oregon, because one of the things that we've done is taken a piecemeal approach to how our revenue restructuring, some of our spending ideas and that sort of thing. And I think that that's one of the things that has created some of the problems that we have. And it will also utilize some of the resources that we already have and modify others and potentially eliminate others. But I think that, you know, the idea here is that we try to figure out how we can best approach the stabilized funding for our school systems and particularly our K-12. And I think that that can also get us into being able to stabilize our higher ed system as well. And I think over the course of time, one of the things I would like to do is change the dynamics of the conversation from being one of K-12 to being one of K-16. With that, let me just kind of run these ideas by you. One would be that in a constitutional amendment, I guess, would be to require the State Assembly to set an annual authority for each school district as far as what their per-child spending would be, and then that the state funding formula would meet 90% of the authority based on the QEM, on the quality education model. And then and the formula would maintain the current measure $5 per thousand that schools currently have, but then another part to it would be that the school districts would gain the ability to go outside of Measure 5 and fund their schools at the difference between whatever the state is funding and what the full authority is. Just because I'll use $10,000 as the figure as an example, because I can do the math easier in my head. But let's say, for example, the legislature set the spending authority at $10,000. The legislature would be expecting to fund at $9,000, and that would leave a $1,000 gap that the local district could make up. Or they could say, we're not going to go to the full authority, we're going to stay at $9,000. That would be their choice. And if they did go to the full authority, then it would be with the blessing of their voters.
So, Representative Krimmel, just to get to the nut of your idea, from what I understood last night, it's the state would provide 90% of the QEM.
Of the QEM, correct.
And then the local option would be for, I guess, our committee to consider would
That's correct.
giving them the option to go get that other 10 if their voters so choose.
Absolutely. And I would also suggest that that we eliminate the current state funding formula. I think that the state I represent Sherwood. Sherwood has been penalized over the last 12 years because of their support for schools in the 1980s, and consequently they are the lowest funded district in the state. And I think that it's very unfortunate that they've been penalized the way that they have. And so in terms of the funding formula, what I would suggest is that we eliminate the current formula and go to a straight formula, number of students, amount of money, divide one into the other, and that gives you your per student funding. So that's the idea. You did kind of hurry me up a little bit, and which I need to get up to House Judiciary anyway. The other idea, or the other part of it, would be with IDEA.
Yeah.
Take those federal dollars and put them, give those to the districts that actually have IDEA kids. There it is.
Thank you. Hold on 1 second. Questions?
Thank you
for your time. Appreciate it.
I'll go next.
Representative Kafouri.
Thank you. House Democratic Leader Deborah Kafouri, thank you very much for allowing us the opportunity to speak before you today on SJR 18. I served on the Revenue Committee in 1999 and was a part of the very first local option bill. And we saw then the need for legislative action to help bring flexibility to Oregon's public education system by allowing local districts to use local option money to pay for instructional programs. I worked very closely with two of our previous speakers, the Treasurer and State Representative Shirley, to persuade then-Governor Kitzhaber not to veto the bill. And we helped to assure him that that local option was an important step to ensure high-quality public education in every school district, both rural and urban. Local governments and school districts need flexibility in determining how to help their local schools. The local option ensures more local control, which I believe is an essential feature. I believe SJR 18 is important for both the short-term and the long-term health of our school system. In the short term, I believe it helps bridge the gap. Shortfalls in state revenue have forced deep cuts in local education. Local communities need some means to bridge the gap in education support that those cuts have caused. And increasing the local option limit gives them the means to maintain high-quality education for their children. And it also reinforces local citizens' control over local schools. I believe, though, that it also is important for the long-term solution, and we must not forget that we still face the issue of providing a sane, sustainable, and adequate system of funding public education in Oregon. And I don't think that the local option issue should detract us from that goal, and it still remains my number one priority this session. But I think that once we get there, which I hope we do, we still need the local option piece to allow communities to add extras if they think it's necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Superintendent, former revenue officer, Jim Scherzinger.
Smarty pants.
And smarty pants.
Smarty pants. Jim Scherzinger, Portland Public Schools superintendent. I'm here to be clear, if there has been any confusion, that Portland Public Schools supports a local option. If there has been a confusion, I believe it's because our first choice is a statewide tax along the lines of, or perhaps the lines that Senator Corcoran was mentioning. We believe in equal education for all Oregon kids. We happen to be a tax donor district, in other words, a rich district. But nonetheless, we believe that a statewide tax is the preferred choice. We're willing to contribute, and we think it should be attractive to a, say, property poor or a less wealthy district, because they can impose a dollar tax and get back $1.30 or $1.40 in revenue for their schools, and we believe that should be attractive. So that is our first choice, is a statewide tax. But lacking that, and I think that's what we're hearing, is that is lacking, we support a local option. And I want to emphasize the reason I think that the Portland community supports a local option. And it's why you see the business community and our local city and county elected officials so supportive of trying to find a local option in this situation is that they have seen what has happened in other urban areas. They have seen what has happened to other urban school districts. And they know that if we lose our ability to attract all the kids in our community, the high income as well as the low income, that that means something for an urban school district, and it begins the devolution of the district. It's happened in so many communities that it's a high priority to them. The business community out there recruiting people and companies to come to the metro area, the quality of the school system is important to them, and that's why they're willing to step up and time and again to support a local option. Again, that is our second choice, but we do support it, lacking the adequate statewide system. One additional thing, I don't have the same problem that Senator Corcoran has with a local option. I don't believe that the existence of a local option would preclude a statewide solution. And I really have two reasons for that. Number one, I see in my community, and I just came from a meeting where they're trying to craft the local option package that you may have read about in the paper. And they have been adamant in crafting that, that it be done in a way that made it very clear that it did not take the legislature or the state off the hook in trying to provide a statewide solution. That's a primary consideration in both limiting the length of the measure and putting in provisions that would make it clear that the preference is a statewide tax. And the second reason is that I think if you look across the state, that the general rule will be, and it's certainly not true everywhere, but the general rule will be, it is those areas that are struggling economically that are the ones where getting support for a statewide tax is so difficult. And it's those areas that might do a local option where the support is the strongest. And we are willing to vote for these kinds of measures, even though we're, as I said, a net donor area. And it's even our preferred solution. So I don't really see that that existence of a local option in our situation is going to change that. I think that will always be the preferred choice.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Corcoran.
Well, Jim, but I mean, walk through the logic of that. If you allowed, let's say that this bill was enacted and you had votes in Corvallis, Portland, you know, the four counties that passed, you know, Measure 28. In my district, you could have Eugene would pass one in a heartbeat, right? But the Cottage Groves and the Lowells would continue to be incapable of doing that for a variety of reasons, including their tax base. What do you think, honestly, that there would be a sympathetic level after those have school districts passed their increases to look at a statewide solution?
There are two reasons I believe it to be true. Number one, I know that any local provision that we're going to get is going to be limited. It's going to be conditioned on the lack of a statewide solution, so that it will not be the situation where it's going to be built into our measure incentives to be sure that the state isn't left off the hook. So in our particular case, I can't speak for everyone else. But the second reason I believe that to be true, and this is very true in the business community, it's a competitive issue, that their preference is the broadest tax that you can get, that a higher tax in one local area over another is viewed to be a competitive issue. And their preference would be a statewide tax because it's a broader tax across a broader area, and they don't see the same local area competitive concerns that they would see with a local tax. And that's, they're willing to take it in order to provide for schools during a period of extreme difficulty, but they don't like that kind of situation in the long run.
Mr. Chair, I just have to say, with all due respect, I mean, they just had a forum in December in Portland, and the only thing that 1,300 of our smartest business leaders in the state could come up with was a revenue-neutral sales tax. So you have more faith in them than I do.
Thank you, Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
First of all, I want to tell Mr. Scherzinger that I agree that we have extraordinary circumstances and may need some heroic measures in this context. And I agree with him also that we need a assistance during that period of extremity. So that, to me, would indicate a limited duration solution, not a permanent solution that derives from this local option. I mean, I think local option is the wrong term. I think local initiative ought to be better because local option is a specific constitutional amendment that we've made to allow some communities that are not under compression to increase their tax base. But I'd like to ask Mr. Scherzinger, Mr. Chairman, since he was the one who crafted the equalization funding formula in 1991, to help us understand why it's necessary that we have one.
Why it's necessary that we have a local option.
No, why it's necessary that there be an equalization funding formula.
Oh. Well, there are a number of answers to the question, and I don't want to take all your time, so I'll try to be as brief as I can. I think there is a legal constitutional one, and that relates to the fact that under Measure 5, there was no local option. And so all we had essentially an equal $5 tax for education across the state, and all other revenue sources were essentially statewide sources. And so you then, under a uniform system of common school sort of constitutional standard, that you needed to equalize funding across the state because there was no way for local people to raise their own funds with their own taxing power for schools. The provision of a local option starts moving back to a system before where that would be constitutionally permissible. Because the court decisions in Oregon that have gone to the Supreme Court have found that differences in funding of schools are appropriate if they're created by local people imposing taxes on themselves to create those differences. And so as you move back to a local option, the differences become constitutionally permissible. So that's sort of the legal answer to the question. I think you have a whole set of issues around public policy and equal opportunity to education that would argue for equalization as well. And that's a more...
that was the issue that I was after.
Right.
It was we could probably talk for hours about the ethical and moral considerations and the community that comes with equal opportunity for education. But the overriding issue for me is equal protection clause under the Constitution, that you can't set up a systematic program for funding education that essentially delivers disequity rather than equity. So, and I think that is the underpinning of the equalization funding formula, almost more than any other thing. But he got to that issue for me.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Scherzinger.
Carolyn Ortman from Hillsborough Board, Cyril Gable from Corvallis, and Don Bonder.
I will start since I'm up here first. My name is Carolyn Ortman and Chair Deckert in committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you. I am here today as a board member for the Hillsborough School District. We are the fourth largest school district in the state. We had the privilege of taking that from Eugene. We have over 18,000 students in Hillsborough. We represent areas of Hillsborough, Reedville, North Plains, Groner, Farmington View, West Union, Orenco, parts of Cornelius, Alloa, and unincorporated Washington County. We are a large district. We are one of those tax exporters, and we are also one of those, quote, rich districts. Hillsborough School District has had positive responses from our voters in construction bonds. I've spoke to you about that before. We've approved on ourselves $178 million in our last three bond levies in less than 6 years. We have a demonstration of our voters' willingness to support Hillsborough schools and students at the local level. This was a hard one for me. As many of the other speakers have spoke about, this is a tool, and it's a really important tool, but it's not the whole toolbox, and it shouldn't be construed to be that. But it is an important tool. To be able to tax an additional $2 per thousand would be viewed positively, and I would appreciate this opportunity to talk to my local districts and my local district and my community about the options that would present for them. It restores a portion of the local control that's been talked about, but what local control really means is the opportunity for voters to have a direct link and a direct impact with their pocketbooks on what's happening in their schools. Short of returning completely to the levy system that happened before, it provides opportunities and choices. I have a really difficult time understanding how we can tell students that they can be anything that they want to be, that they should study hard, that they can go after their calling, that they can do everything that's available to them. And at the same time, we don't do that. We set ceilings, not floors. We aren't providing opportunities. There's no direct connection. When I look at what this major means to Hillsborough, our assessed value in 97 was over $5 billion. 5 years later, that's up nearly 58% to a little over $8 billion. Under the provisions, not counting the Dash Amendment, the provisions of the SJR 18, our school district would have the opportunity of going forward for over an additional $13 million with local voter approval. To put that in context, my district is looking at cutting upwards of 17 school days this calendar year. We're looking at cutting, based on proposed projections, between $18 and $20 million next year. To give an opportunity to my voters to say that's not acceptable and we'd be willing to tax ourselves for over $13 million of that, that's a very strong and powerful message. I think my voters would also be here and not want me to miss the opportunity to say, but again, it is just a tool. It is not the toolbox, and you need to look at the long-term issue. The students that continue to go out every year don't get another chance. We have to have some sort of a short-term solution. I don't really care if you make it a 3-year or 5-year. I don't care how you do that. But while we're having this discussion and trying to figure out how we're going to solve a long-term solution, we have to have some options. And right now, there are very, very few options that are available to us. I'm not even sure if it matters if it's called the local option or the local whatever. But to me, what it means is that I can go back to my schools and I can say to students, what we tell you is what we really mean and we're really going to try and do, instead of continuing to just take away and slash budgets and increase our class size and tell them that the things we ask them to dream about, really, they don't matter.
Carolyn, are you sure you don't care that it's three, if there was a 3 or 5 year? I mean, what that would entail is that you're back having this very continual type conversation.
I care that if you come up with a long-term solution, but it has to go hand in hand. If you want to be a short-term solution, it has to be tied to the fact that when you come up with a long-term solution, then this can go away.
That would be natural.
Okay. Thank you.
I just a question about that.
Saringa.
Thank you.
I just want help.
I'm trying to help you, Carol. I want help, too. Do you think there is a structural advantage in going back to more of a local funding base, just based on the community connections as opposed to the state funding base? Is that a better way to manage?
Yeah, Chair Deckert and Senator Ringo, yes, I do believe that. I one of my other hats is I co-chair our citizens group. One of the biggest complaints that we are continuing to hear more and more is, why is it even matter if I go to Salem? Are they going to listen? Are they going to hear? And how come I can't tell you as my board member that this is what I want and you can't do it? And I'm responsible to oversee the policy and the mandates, but I don't have the option to go to them and lay it out and just say, here's what we believe, here's what you're telling us as a community is important.
Well, doesn't that suggest that returning to more of a local option base would be a the way to go in the long run, that it should not be sunset in 3 or 5 years?
That's probably true, but my authorization here is to get what I can get.
let's not set our sights too low.
I'll take both.
Thank you.
Would you like me to go next?
Please.
My name is Cyril Gable. I come here wearing several hats. I'm the mother of two children in the Corvallis schools who have spent their entire school careers experiencing reductions in the opportunities available to them. I'm also a member of the Corvallis Education Coalition and the statewide coalition for school funding now. Additionally, I come here as a Corvallis school board member, and I'm quite familiar, like you are finding yourselves today, with presiding over massive budget reductions, because I've gotten to do that many times during my tenure. I am here in support of SJR 18, and I'd like to just put that in context. Depending upon which state budget predictions you believe, our district is expecting anywhere from $5 to $7 million in cuts next year. That's on approximately a $40 million budget. We'll likely eliminate our remaining meager elementary PE and music, all athletics, and myriad other programs. We'll be asking employees to take zero increases in salary and benefits. This year's reductions were no picnic either. Despite closing three schools at the end of last year and implementing additional layoffs last year in anticipation of this year's difficulties, we'll be cutting 7 school days this spring. Even in the best of times, during the 90s, the state did not live up to its promise to fund public education adequately, in my opinion. The quality education model is a carefully researched prototype for delivery of a fine education, and we've never come close to funding things based on their recommendations. Now we're in an economic crisis, and we can't provide the necessary funding. So it's time to give local communities the opportunity to rescue their schools. I do believe that SJR 18 begins to address this need, and particularly with the additional amendments that you've talked about, I think it will become quite a useful tool for districts. Corvallis is already in serious discussions about local revenue options already available. The City Council and School Board met in joint session this past Monday. A citizens group is also meeting to explore possibilities. As we all know, though, one of the most viable options already in use by other communities is for the city to use their property tax base. And this has the unfortunate side effect of reducing the city's ability to provide their core services, police and fire protection. And so, of course, they're not wildly enthusiastic, but they also recognize the crisis that schools have been in for far longer than they have. So it would be far better for schools to have the ability to raise their own funds. The objections from this approach, as we've heard today, will come from those worried about a loss of equalization. Of course, we could spend days arguing about whether the current formula represents true equity anyway, but nonetheless, what it sounds like to me is, at this point, given the state's current funding, it means we would all be equally mediocre. And I would argue that this is no time to force every student in our state to go down with the sinking ship. I do not agree that just because one community cannot raise additional funds that all of Oregon's children should suffer. So thank you very much for bringing these ideas forward, and I will track them carefully.
Thank you very much.
As a graduate of the Corvallis school system, I'd just say those cuts you described are really heartbreaking.
And we really appreciate the help that your father gave us in passing our recent bond measure.
Did he help?
Yes, he did. Very definitely.
You know, one thought that I had that while you were testifying is I think districts, absent some sort of state relief, and maybe that is accurately describes what we're contemplating here, but absent some statewide action, I would think the districts such as Corvallis will find, as Portland did, some way to save their schools. And it'll be very scattered. It'll be very hard to measure because they'll find unique, Corvallis might find one unique solution as Portland did that Beaverton mm-hmm. or Fulton might. But I think it would be a real scattered lack of coherency to the way, but I don't think citizens in the state, that is just my gut feeling, would allow mm-hmm. the cuts that are, if you look at the next school year after September, I don't think citizens would allow that to happen. But I guess your testimony really did point out, I think, a fear that if we don't do something, that we'll just see that type of activity across the state.
So you'll be losing your equalization anyway. It'll just be through various other mechanisms. I mean, in addition to the city's property tax base, we're also looking at a restaurant and entertainment tax or a personal income tax. I mean, we're trying to explore all the options. So we'll do something.
Say that loud enough, and you'll have those groups in here testifying in support of this bill.
There you go.
Don.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Bonder. My son Matthew is a second grader in the Beaverton School District, and I work with our citizens group, Citizens for Beaverton Schools. With me today are other Beaverton parents behind me who took the time to drive down here today expressly to show their concern about their schools and what it means to their children. They would all like to tell you their stories. However, out of deference to your time and fairness to others wanting to testify, only a few of us are presenting testimony today. I mention this because I want you to know that there are many who hold these beliefs and support these positions. We are here today to voice support for Senate Joint Resolution 18, and particularly the concept of granting more local control to our school districts. My comments are based upon my observations as a parent as well as an involved community member. 2 days ago, I participated in a budget forum at my son's elementary school. I watched our principal near tears for 20 minutes while she explained the proposed budget cuts for 2003 and 2004. The other parents were universally expressing anger and frustration. There was fear and hopelessness among the staff members. And during the question period at the end of the forum, the same question kept coming up. And essentially it was, what can we do to prevent this? And the only answer panel members could supply was hope for a miracle. As you know, the same scene is playing out across our district as well as at schools across the state. The Beaverton School District has drained its reserves to survive this current school year. We are looking at massive layoffs, overcrowded classrooms, and unprecedented reduction in programs for the coming year. What is most devastating is that we are powerless to prevent these losses. Powerlessness does not lead to vibrant communities. Powerlessness leads to desperation. A healthy economy is not built upon powerlessness and desperation. If anyone has any doubt that our declining education system is dragging down our depressed economy even further, they should come and talk to some of my neighbors. There are Nike managers that cannot fill open positions because they can't get qualified candidates to move here to accept their jobs because of the public school system. There are Intel employees who came here for a lucrative job and the quality of life Oregon offered. Now they have their golden handcuffs off. There's no reason for them to stay here if Oregon is not going to be their home for the quality of life it offers. And to me, one of the most devastating results of our current situation is how this crisis has pitted Oregonian against Oregonian. There are so many people fighting for their fair share of a decreasing pool of funds. I don't like to come down here in big groups and lobby you for more funds for my child while there's a woman standing next to me saying, I'm going to die if I don't get that money. That doesn't make me feel really good. But it's what I need to do for my child, and I'm going to do it. And she's going to be here, and she's going to do it. We shouldn't have to be here together doing that. Powerlessness and desperation have caused our survival instincts to overwhelm our community instincts. Effective solutions to this crisis cannot involve taking from one group to give to another group. An increase in the property tax limit to allow school districts to collect additional revenue to be used for their operating expenses would assist school districts and communities in controlling their own fate. With respect to education, we're going to have to work on our other problems. Without taking from the current dry pool, I'm sure that the proponents of statewide equalization did not envision bringing down the funding of all schools to an equally low level. I wish we were here today to discuss a proposal to drastically increase funding for schools statewide. Every child in the state of Oregon should receive a high-quality education, regardless of his or her county of residence. But given the depressed economy and our current tax structure, I don't see this as a possibility at this time. Our present statewide funding system for Oregon school is failing all of our children. Our state needs to offer communities the opportunity to save their schools. We get the question of, is this fair? And I don't know. But what I do know is that it is unfair to let all of our schools fail for the sake of fairness. I know there are really raw wounds on both sides of this issue. Rural districts are irate about having to share their timber money, their federal timber money, statewide. And they don't have the taxing power of urban and suburban districts to raise the type of money that these local initiatives or local options are going to supply for other districts. Then you have the other side. School districts in the Tri-County area are outraged over the recent Oregonian analysis calculating that Tri-County districts send nearly $400 million in taxes to support schools elsewhere in the state. Any solution requiring more dollars to be sent outside these districts is probably doomed to failure. We need to get by these wounds and work towards a plan that allows for local intervention. Then we need to move to finding a stable source of school money statewide. The local Band-Aid that an increase in property tax limits will allow is not sufficient, and therefore it's not a cure. But it is an all-important start. I don't think we can underestimate the potential statewide benefits of allowing communities that can help themselves to do so. I don't see how avoiding massive layoffs and keeping high-wage earners from leaving the state of Oregon is going to hurt other communities. I see it as an ability to perhaps maintain some income tax revenue to the general fund, and then the ability of these dollars to be available for schools statewide. And perhaps even more importantly, I think this will enable communities to control the fate of their school systems, and this will empower these communities and broaden the myopic view that the survival mode has created. I'm telling you, it's like Lord of the Flies out there, okay? It will permit a return of the concern for the state of the whole that will aid you in making critical systemic changes that truly control the fate of our state's survival. And it's here, I wish Senator Feroli was here, and I'm glad that Senator Corcoran is back, because I want to say that I really believe that finding a statewide solution is critical, and I see this as an assistance to doing that. Because until we make these people who are out there feeling so protective of their own box open their eyes and see what else is going on, your ability to pass something statewide is incredibly limited. You need to get these people on board with you. And my work with the citizens group has shown me that they've lost that ability to be compassionate and to be empathetic. And by giving them some control over their own fate and being able to help those who can help themselves move up a little bit, I think you're going to be able to get into their hearts a little bit more and make them see that there's a bigger picture out there. I want to thank Senator Ringo and Representative Haas for co-sponsoring the bill before us. And I did not know of all the other support until I got here today, but Representative Shetterly for his work on the issue on the House side as well. And I want to thank you, Senator Deckert, for being courageous and beginning this dialogue. Enabling communities to save their schools is not unfair, but leaving our children to rely upon miracles to provide them with a quality education is clearly unfair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I appreciate your comments about the cannibalization of social services, education, and to some degree public safety, although there's not much sympathy for that in the building. But again, you know, I don't think we have a strategic difference. I think we have a tactical difference. And I think you need to understand that it's not a matter of being protective. I mean, I have a school district that's in very good shape, 4J. I don't care if we're second or third or fourth. You know, the fact is it's a large school district, and with economies of scale doesn't suffer nearly as badly. And the housing values in Eugene are much greater than the ones in Oak Ridge and Lowell and Drain and Elkton and Yoncalla and Glide and Sutherland. Well, maybe not Sutherland. But the fact of the matter is, I understand it from both perspectives, but I think the tactical difference is that you think that the have school districts can take care of themselves, and somehow that'll bring everybody up to realize they should take care of themselves, too, when they can't. And that, to me, just doesn't make sense.
Senator, with all due respect, I don't think that. I think that by enabling communities such as mine to take care of themselves, mm-hmm. you're going to inspire their generosity to then vote for measures that are more broad-based and keep them as a donor community to help the others,
they
because right now they're not willing to do that.
Okay.
I might just also mention that, again, though it's not contained in SJR 18 as it currently stands, Representative Shetterly's package and the various other amendments that Senator Ringo is putting together, again, build this equalization fund so that any community who wants to show voter support will have access to money to support their local schools. So I think that that's an important thing to remember.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you very much. Senator Ringo.
I mean, just to comment to Senator Corcoran, I think that if the Tri-County area and some of the other, like Eugene, Corvallis area, loses that critical mass of public support for their schools, and there is the flight from the public school system that has occurred in so many other states, that is going to be so devastating to every school district in this state, including the rural areas, because you're going to lose that support that drives a strong public education system across the board. I mean, I truly believe it is in the strong interest of rural school districts to see success in the larger areas.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I mean, it would seem to me if you really were concerned about the entire state rather than the have areas, you would look more closely at a statewide solution.
Well, Mr. Chair, to respond to that, we tried a very, very slight statewide solution. It was called Measure 28. I mean, many legislators, including one sitting on this panel, actively lobbied against the passage of that.
That's right.
And absent strong support for a statewide solution, which you don't see, I don't see, we need to throw a lifeline to districts to help themselves.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I disagree with the analysis that you don't, that there is no option in terms of a statewide solution. I think if there had not been the organized opposition that the leadership in this building led against Measure 28, that indeed could have passed. And I also believe that there's very clear polling that I've been watching for 10 years that have been done by a variety of organizations that show very clearly that if we can successfully educate motivated voters on why we got to where we are in terms of our tax crisis, our overdependency on income tax and so forth, that we could in fact have a statewide solution that would provide more adequate funding for schools and human services and not have us at each other's throats. I just think that this is a tactical debate, not a, you know, I think we both agree with the ends of this. I think it's more of a tactical question.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thank
you.
At your places, you also have some testimony submitted by our local Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you. Jason Williams from Oregon Taxpayers Association. Teresa Kiddings.
For me.
For yourself, representing yourself. That's always good. And Tina Impel from Corvallis. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's good to be here, and thank you for having this hearing. For the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. And I just wanted to bring us back to why Measure 5 passed in the first place, and that was because a lot of folks were having a hard time staying in their home. They just could not afford it. Property taxes were too high. And when you take people out of their home and you take people out of their job because of overtaxation, the economy goes down and everyone suffers. And we're beginning to see that again here with the recession. People are having a hard time affording themselves. And I think that is something that's sometimes lost with Measure 28, is that, yes, people are having a hard time just making their lives live and doing some of the basic things that they need to do. And that's why even in November, with most of the property tax and local tax measures across the state, most of them, those local tax measures failed. And that tells us that there is, you know, there's something else going on here. And I don't want to come here just to oppose the bill. I would like to find, have some ideas here for more money for education. I have four ideas. One of them is urban renewal. It's time to get rid of that. I think that is ruining the property tax debate, because it's taking money off the top and giving it for programs. And what we're seeing across the state with the, you know, the city of Wilsonville trying to use $3 million of their urban renewal funds to build themselves a new city hall. I mean, there are horror stories like that all across the state. And to me, that urban renewal money should be spent in the general fund of those local governments. And that urban renewal money that's being spent now needs to be returned to the schools, needs to be returned to the local governments. So I would like to see, it'd be great if you guys could put out a bill that would just say, let urban renewal be taken off the books, let it be just a locally driven mechanism. We'd also like to see getting rid of some tax breaks that affect the properties. The vertical housing tax breaks that are out there. Portland alone is spending like $24 million, taking that much tax money off the books just for businesses that are located near light rail and transit stations. Why are we giving out millions and millions of dollars for something that just has no priority whatsoever? Number three, with more local control, we could start by getting rid of the education mandates, SIM and CAM, and a lot of things that we feel interfere with the local school districts. I would love to return as much local control over the curriculum, over the classrooms, over the teaching to the local level as possible. And finally, there have been a lot of complaints about there are millions and millions of taxpayer dollars that's being missed because the state owns property, empty property, and it's not gaining any tax value out of it. Sometimes there's nothing there. And I would like to see this body examine how much government is in the property ownership business when there is no reason it should be owning that property. And that's another case where we could take money that is simply off the rolls, that's not getting any income, and let it produce itself. Let the free market take control and help revive the economy. So those are some of our helpful solutions, but we just don't think that the public really needs an increase in property taxes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just a couple of quick questions. On the fourth point, do you have specific public ownership lands that you would point out to us to start looking at? Or?
Yeah, well, I've been in discussion with one of the lawmakers here in the building, and I'll try to get you some of the stuff that what he brought to my attention.
And second, just one other. In terms of a statewide vote, you understand in this bill that it requires, because it is a constitutional revision, it requires a statewide vote. Do you guys still oppose it, even though it's allowing the people to actually pass judgment on this and then allowing a local community the ability, if they so choose, and it would be up just to those voters if they decided based on self-determination to actually increase their taxes?
So you're saying, do we want to give people the vote on this bill?
The bill gives them that option. The bill's got.
No, I mean, there's been a lot of tax increases that have been thrown. Measure 28. I think people, with Measure 28, the people spoke loud and clear. Is they feel that there just needs to be more reprioritization here in government, more management of what they have, the resources that they do give them. So that's. I think they're tired of having these things thrown at them at the ballot.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, I was just going to expand on your notion that the property tax, property that's off the rolls, be put on the rolls. How do you feel, just from your organization's perspective, on fraternal organizations and churches?
fraternal organizations and churches being off the property tax rolls, I think there are things that the society holds near and dear to their heart that have been here before government was, and that is, you know, government is that churches is not something that you you know, like to see as much little as government interference as possible.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
And how do you feel about the tax deduction for mortgage interest for second homes and yachts?
Wait, could you repeat the question there?
How do you feel about the current tax expenditure that allows tax deduction for mortgage interest on second homes and yachts?
You know, I'd have to take a look at that. I would like to also ask you, with if I could ask a question, would you like to see churches being taxed, property tax?
Pardon?
Senator Corcoran, would you like to see churches pay property tax?
No.
Okay.
I don't belong to your organization. I would have liked to have seen Measure 28 pass.
Appreciate your do appreciate your time,
you.
And you're welcome to stay or go however you wish. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I appreciate this opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Tina Ample, and I am a Corvallis City Councilor. And this is my first term, and I'm speaking as myself and not representing the council. But I wanted to give you a local government perspective of what we're struggling with, because I think that's really important for you to hear. Here in my very first term, we're looking at a $1.7 million reduction for the Corvallis budget. And yet we are willing to work with the school board, because we will not see our schools fail. And Senator Deckert, you're quite right. We will do whatever we need to do. And Senator Corcoran, I completely agree with you. We don't have any interest in letting the state off the hook here. This is your guys' responsibility, because we should have an equal and good quality of education in the whole state. But quite frankly, we have lost our trust that this legislative body has the will and the courage to take care of the problem. So if you can't take care of it, we're going to take care of it. And we may end up taking care of it in ways that, Senator Deckert, you're quite correct, will not be as happily embraced, whether it's a payroll tax or an income tax or an entertainment and food tax, but we're going to find a solution for this problem. And that is why I'm supporting this today. My preference would be what your, I assume your preference is. But I'm tired of seeing Oregon represented as the Mississippi of the West. I'm tired of that.
Yes,
I also
even mad at us.
Well, you know, absolutely.
Looking good.
Yeah, and I've got no fondness for picking up the paper and seeing the state of Oregon ridiculed in Doonesbury. You know, I'm in a position where I'm working between a whole community of interests that are sliding backwards in these times. And it's important that Corvallis maintains HP. It's also important that Corvallis maintains Oregon State University, because that's the basis from which we draw our community support from. We're not going to attract and keep good people if they don't have good schools to put their children in. They will not continue to locate in Corvallis, and that's not in our best interest. So I'm going to urge you strongly, find a solution to this problem in addition to supporting the local control, because we're going to find a solution that you're probably not going to like, but we're going to find a solution.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have never been involved in government in the past, so here is your opportunity to be heroes to me. I'm very optimistic that you can reach a long-term solution to this problem, because you are hearing from so many people that it's an issue that we want fixed. With respect to that, I would like for us to keep our long-term education needs in mind while we're working on solutions, and that is having high-quality education for our K-12 schools, creating a highly trained workforce, keeping the current employers we have in our state, and attracting new businesses to our state. But first of all, how are we going to create that world-class workforce if we can't even maintain basic levels of quality education for our elementary schools? I'm the mother of a 5-year-old who's in kindergarten and a 3-year-old who's in preschool. I'm also a CPA who works part-time from home, and I volunteer in my daughter's classroom. I have a pretty good idea about what an acceptable student-teacher ratio is. My husband, to give some background, has a PhD in mechanical engineering, and he works for Intel. We moved here in 1995. I moved here from Alabama, but we'll talk about that later. But we both agree that funding and supporting all levels of education in our whole state is crucial to the viability of our state, the economic viability of our state. Last month, the parents of our school were informed that given the current level of state funding for the Beaverton School District, we are likely to lose 26% of our teachers in our elementary school. This is 26% of teachers in our elementary school. This school has a population of around 600 children. In addition to that, we are likely to see a reduction of at least 5 to 6 school work days. That doesn't seem like a lot to a lot of people, but when we're already below the national average of school days, that's also unacceptable to me. We are substantially increasing our class sizes, going to kindergarten and first grade class sizes without an aide of 29 to 30 children. This news came with a groundswell of support as to what the community could do about these concerns. We now have people from our local school, I would guess around 150 people, working at all levels of government trying to see what we can do. We've gone to the school board, we're going to budget committees, we're talking to our legislatures, whatever we can do to make a change. Having my first grader in a classroom with 29 to 30 other children and my future kindergarten in the same number is not acceptable to me and does not make me feel they're going to receive a quality education. I'm afraid that so many people in my similar circumstances will just opt for private school. I don't want that to happen. That's not the route I want to take. I do believe in quality education for everyone. And if everybody in my community jumps ship and goes to private schools, they're not going to give any more money to our state. I believe that having a strong-funded public school system supports our state in innumerable ways. I know that most of you already see that. I'm asking you to make adequate school funding a priority. I'm also asking you to consider alternative funding sources. It cannot be business as usual. It is not business as usual in our schools. Oregonians need our leaders to make tough and sound decisions. We don't know, nor can we predict, when the next recession will be. I don't want to have the same discussion in 4 to 6 years, and I don't believe you guys want to have the same discussion in 4 to 6 years either. I think it's important for you to know I'm fiscally very conservative. I've never voted for a tax increase in my life. However, I will, at this point, vote for one. It is time to really challenge traditional methods and to stand up for the priorities of our state. I do believe that we can make a difference together. It seems that having our income taxes fund most of our school dollars is not a stable or adequate system. I know caps on property tax funding currently limit us, but I'm in agreement that we should raise the rates and let local communities control that. I want to thank Senator Decker for leading this charge in our particular community. I would also be supportive. Nobody's talked about this. Nobody threw anything at me. I'm also supportive of the sales tax in conjunction with a decrease in income taxes. But it can provide some stable funding, and I just would like to know that it's being considered. I would also like to address the failure of Measure 28. I believe Measure 28 did not fail due to apathy for education, or the fact that people don't care about our needy. It failed because there's a lack of trust with our legislature. We need to know that our legislature is spending our money for the right things and the right priorities. That's what I'm hearing from the people that I know. Why should I send any more money to Salem if they cannot manage it, accountably and responsibly? Okay, I'll stop there. But by allowing more local control of school funding, people at the local level will have more ability to make sure that priorities are funded, and they are more likely to support targeted future tax increases if we know people will act responsibly. I also want to thank each of you for our service to your community and to our state and also to our country, and I mean that wholeheartedly. I know it is not an easy job. With all this uncertainty that surrounds our lives in today's world, I am thankful that there are qualified and thoughtful, genuinely concerned people like you leading us. That's what I have to say.
Questions?
No questions for me?
Okay. Thank you. People did not throw tomatoes. They don't like this. Just so you know. Nancy Winston, we're getting actually near time. We got 15 minutes. I want to get our school board people. John, Ozzy, do you want to come up? And Nancy, are there other... And you're... Come on, get close, Lori. And...
Tim,
come on up, and we'll just... If you're on my list and haven't spoke, just come closer. Ozzy, or John, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Just between us, I wish we weren't here today. I wish we were here debating a way to raise the level of the lake for every school district and every student in Oregon. Unfortunately, for circumstances certainly beyond my control, we're not there. So the question is, what can we do in the short term to fix the school funding crisis faced by many schools in many communities? We're appearing here in support of the concept of a local option. One of the tragedies, I think, of Measure 5 was it totally seems to have eliminated the connection between citizens and their communities and their schools. And I think it's extremely important to get that back. And even if we were in a conversation about a long-term solution to provide adequate and stable funding, I think a component of that will still have to be some kind of a connection between schools and their communities in terms of the ability to raise money locally and spend money locally and boards being accountable to their local communities. There are several issues inside the local option concept that I believe will ultimately be resolved. They were recognized to you earlier by Representative Shetterly. And the first is how the local option is constructed. If you're going to give us local option opportunity, I think it has to be constructed in a way that's easier to understand than the current local option that we have. And I'm hopeful that the dollars per thousand will be based on real market value, that it will be able to be levied district-wide, and we won't have the issue of the property-by-property compression and school districts not knowing how much a local option will raise until it's actually imposed. Certainly the issue of equalization has to be addressed, and we're hopeful that we can look at some measure of caps as exist for the existing local option, as well as equalization grants, so that there's some method to raise up those the opportunity for those lower wealth school districts. We're also hopeful that if granted local option authority, that you won't hamstring us with a double majority. I think that gives citizens that want to sit home the ability to effectively vote no, and we don't need that. To the issue of the extent to which granting us local option authority now will detract from a discussion and consideration of the long term. On average, school districts now rely about to the tune of 30% for local resources, 70% for state resources. What you're doing is assisting us or enhancing that 30%. There, you're still on the hook for responsibility for enhancing the 70%. And while the local option may help in the short term, it doesn't get you off the hook for dealing with the long term. And finally, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there have been those that have spoken before me that have more articulately expressed the desire by local communities to take their schools back. And we certainly hope that you will give the local option due consideration. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corkin.
John, I was asking the same question I've been asking. I mean, don't you think that putting this out for a vote now will lower the chances of a longer-term solution in terms of trying to do something statewide? How can this possibly help?
As I said, Mr. Chairman and Senator Corcoran, what we're looking at is an opportunity to enhance the smaller portion of the school funding. There will be those that will believe if this measure were to pass that the job is done, and it's going to be our task to explain to them it hasn't been done. that there will be some school districts that for one reason or another won't be successful in their local option. And we all have a responsibility to raise the level of the lake for all school districts, including those that have managed locally to enhance the smaller portion of their funding. Thank you.
And John, just one question on that. Based on your statewide knowledge, do you believe we'll see more examples like Portland? Say we did not enact this, and in June this wasn't on the ballot. Do you see coming more examples like Portland, where cities, in a very incoherent fashion, and sometimes not the best techniques, across the state, find some sort of local solution, just not within guidelines of the state?
Mr. Chairman, I think you will see no end to the local creativity. I believe that communities around Oregon are thinking about a way to revive Oregon's economy. And they're recognizing that schools in many communities are the largest employer and a driving engine in that local economy. And if they want businesses to stay there and businesses to locate there and good living wage jobs to be created there, that it's going to be necessary for them to do something to enhance support for their schools.
Thank you.
Jeff?
Senator Farrelly.
I'll defer to my colleague, Senator Ringo.
Thanks. John, have you had a chance to look at the Dash 1 amendments to SJR 18?
Senator Ringo, I have.
And do those address your concern about the compression and the real market value?
It's not as clear, Senator Ringo, as I'd like. I'm anxious to hear more about the mechanics of exactly how that works. I know that when we've had some private discussions with Representative Shetterly, that was his intent. I guess I'd have to know more about the Dash 1 amendments to assure myself that they do, in fact, address some of the concerns.
Okay, well, I mean, the Dash 1 amendments are about one page, and mm-hmm. I think there's a stack over there, and I would just ask that you take a look at them and do whatever analysis that you think needs to be done, and then let me know.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'd like to remind our colleagues that it wasn't me that referred to the Portland approach as incoherent. the question is a short-term question. We have a short-term solution and a short-term problem. Would you think a sunset would be a reasonable approach on this approach? In other words, if we have a systemic problem and a tax structure problem and we're trying to provide a local option for people to get through a period of time towards a solution, and I think that's what Senator Corcoran's been alluding to right along here. I think a sunset would offer people assurance that there would be a short-term solution, but it would not take the pressure off a long-term solution.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farrelly, I would not want to clutter our already cluttered Constitution with sunset clauses. I think it would be appropriate to amend the Constitution to place this provision there, and then by statute you could certainly limit schools' access to it, much like schools were for a while had access limited to the local option that was contained in Measure 50.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman? Then I'd just like you to touch briefly on the legal necessity of an equalization funding formula.
Senator Farrelly, I don't believe that, at least in Oregon, there is a legal necessity. The courts in Oregon have never dictated that our school funding distribution formula or school funding system be equitable. The only most recent cases came shortly after the 91 enactment of the distribution formula in Deschutes County, now termed the Withers case, where the courts in effect said that there was a rational basis for the legislature to move towards full equalization over an extended period of time so as not to create the short-term massive dislocations. The only other case prior to that was in the late 60s, came out of Southern Lane County, that was termed the Olson case, where the court said in effect, and I think it was referred to earlier, that the legislature has created equal opportunity for communities, and therefore it has satisfied its duty to provide for a uniform and general system of common schools, and that local control overrode, by virtue of local control and giving citizens that equal opportunity, that constitutional provision was satisfied.
And final follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Approximately how many states in the union are under court order for equalization funding formulas?
To my knowledge, Senator Farioli, there have been probably half the states that have had some form of case in their state Supreme Courts filed relating to equity of their school funding. And those are based, obviously, on different provisions in various state constitutions. Some call for an efficient school system, for example, or an efficient system of school funding. So there are literally dozens.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose of this questioning is simply to establish that the equalization funding formula was not accidentally arrived at in this building, that it was not a default position, that it was a strategy to cope with Measure 5 and a strategy to avoid being the subject of litigation that mandated a court system of distribution that we thought probably wouldn't be as equitable or as reasonable or as responsive. Mm-hmm. And I just want to keep reminding people that the equity formula that we have is still designed and to meet a purpose, and that it's probably that we're still under the need for that purpose, and that someday in the future we're going to end up if we are too creative in our creative finance of public schools and the disparity grows too great, we will in fact find ourselves in court defending how it is that schools receive their equalization, or if they in fact are equal under the law. Just want to make that point for the record.
Thank you.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, Senator Farrell, I think as you get into if you decide to proceed with this measure and begin to work on the statutory implementation, then the question I think that we'll all have to think about is what is an acceptable level of disparity. And that, I think, is not necessarily going to be a legal judgment as much as it's going to be a political one. And we can do the computer simulations, and we'll see how much $2 per thousand raises on a per-student basis. And then it's going to be a determination, I think, that we're all going to have to look at in terms of exactly what kind of a disparity you believe and we believe is acceptable.
We are just coming right up on the hour. Senator Ringo.
Just to my colleague from John Day, I've gone to legislative council and asked them whether SJR 18 or a similar measure would run afoul of the Constitution, and been assured it would not. And I respectfully disagree with your assessment that this is a constitutional issue. I think our obligations to equalize are not legal and constitutional. They're ethical in terms of recognizing that everybody deserves a quality education. That's the source of our obligation to equalize. It's not legal or constitutional, but I think it's an obligation we need to take very, very seriously. I would also just point out that we're kind of assuming the districts would immediately pass these local options. I mean, the history of local option passage is not very great, and I don't think we can just assume that districts are going to have an easy time passing these, because experience does not bear that out.
Nancy.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Winston. I'm somewhat of a reluctant community activist because of the school issues. I have a third grade son in the Beaverton School District and a son that's in private kindergarten. I became actively involved in these issues when I saw the Beaverton School District's budget building blocks for next year. They were fairly shocking to me. We have a fiscally conservative school board, which I'm grateful for because I'm also fiscally conservative. And so we haven't had severe cuts at this point because we had reserves to spend down, but they're gone. And if we don't address this adequate funding, our schools are going to look very different next year. We're not going to have physical education, media specialists, music teachers, or any counselors to deal with problems in our schools. And we're also going to lose our instructional aides. As all of you are, I am concerned with every child getting an equal and great education in the state of Oregon. And I definitely, although I am in support of this local option, am willing to work with each of you in my community to pass a statewide solution if you're able to agree on something to refer to us. I came to Oregon in 1986. I was recruited heavily by a high-tech company. There were a lot of promises made to me about the greatness of the state of Oregon, and I agreed. The beaches are public, the mountains are great, and the school system was wonderful in Washington County. I looked at that before we moved here, and with a highly educated workforce there, I was confident that Oregon citizens would keep that school district strong. As a former high-tech manager, I was able to hire the best and brightest and bring them to Oregon. And I'm wondering now, with the cartoons that previous speakers have alluded to, whether I would be able to do that today. Were I still doing that job? As our state suffered through this recession, I've watched the schools deteriorate and followed the debate at all levels within the state. And I agree that it's clear that we need to fund this level of education for all children in our state. It should be high enough that we can be very proud of the results. In addition to that level, local communities should have the option to add to their school's programs in order to attract the businesses that they're recruiting. Different communities may have a different value for what programs added could recruit certain employees. I think each parent with children in our Oregon Public School District has different expectations. I expect art and music education, and I would like daily physical education, which we don't have now. There's a lot of inactivity with our children. I'd like a professionally staffed media system with teachers who inspire children to dream through reading and learn to research effectively. And these are programs that I had in my elementary education, even as my parents changed states 4 times during my first 7 years. I also had a great foreign language program and an immersion in classical music for beginners. I still remember participating in these programs many years later, and I wonder what memories my sons will carry of their education here in Oregon. I believe we need to allow local communities this control, partly because of the trust issue and partly because they may have different requirements for bringing new business to the state, which I believe is the governor's number one agenda item from what I can discern from the newspapers. When we add these businesses to the Oregon tax rolls, our whole community benefits. And I don't think that the governor's thrust for this business development, I believe it could be futile unless we back it up with schools that attract highly educated employees. There are lots of reasons we need to come together to solve this crisis, and we have to act as adults and not burden the children with these adult issues. Soon after the Beaverton schools announced the budget blocks for discussion, I was volunteering at our school. Our principal was shaken up by something, and I asked her what was wrong. She explained that a student who had previously been homeless for 3 years and was now living in a subsidized apartment complex had gone door-to-door and collected $6 in order to save physical education at our school. She didn't want any of her teachers to lose their jobs. The girl said her family also had items they didn't need and would hold a garage sale if it would help. Our principal assured the student that her actions were commendable and that adults in her community, would work to solve the problems for her. I am one of those adults standing here today asking you to join me in helping Oregon's children. I really appreciate all of you listening to me. I'm just an average mom, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear here, and Deckert, Senator Deckert, Chairman Deckert, for allowing this hearing.
Thank you, Nancy, very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I have another hearing that I have to testify to right now, so I'm going to go. But I really do appreciate everybody that came here to testify and give us your wisdom, because in my opinion, this is the most important issue confronting our state. So I just want to say that to everybody here.
Thank you very much. Ozzie.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, director, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and to be sure there's no misunderstanding, Mr. Marshall said he was referring to he and his membership, not to he and I. Sometimes you confuse us, okay?
Mr. Chairman,
that's interference.
Sometimes they confuse us.
this is true.
First of all, these are difficult times, and we have historically supported a local option for a couple of reasons. One, we need to get back on the property tax sum. And notwithstanding the gentleman who talked about people being taxed out of their homes, my home that I've lived in since the 70s, I pay less property tax now than I did in 1991. We're not being taxed out. Another $2 won't do that. Second, we need to get back to having local elections, I believe. I think the communications that you have between the school district and its community are valuable. Now we communicate with our parents, which is 1/4 of our households. There's no reason for us or the community to really formally communicate. And I think local elections would be a good idea for that reason. However, the local option that we've talked about has always been part of a total plan in which there was a basic funded education for every kid in Oregon, no matter the town or the wealth, all that good stuff. And then the local option is in addition to that. So communities can make some choice. Our membership now is badly split on this issue. because the environment in which you're talking local option now isn't that kind of one. It's an environment in which you're talking about throwing a life ring, and some districts, not very many, are going to grab the life ring, and the rest of them aren't. Most of our districts don't believe they will pass a local option. And the, as our regular said, the history of local option vote isn't very good. That's true. That's true. And the current discussion in Ways and Means, I don't know if you talked to those folks, the rumor is they're talking $4.6 billion for schools, $4.5 billion for schools.
I heard that.
Oh. What are we going to say if we offer this as a solution to the 160 or 70 districts that get to live on $4.5 or $4.2 billion, which is considerably less than they've got now? Plus, we would have an equalization component. This would take some more of it away for that. This is not a good answer at this time. And yet others keep painting us in this corner. We can't do anything else in this building. The hell you can't. Excuse me.
Thank you.
You can.
Thank you.
You can. It's going to be hard work, but you can. But you paint us this corner. This is all we can do. And some of our districts say, well, maybe I can get something out of this and a lot to take. And you can't blame them. You can't blame the Portland people for trying to take care of themselves under our scenario. But I would like to posit a different scenario for you. It does not do us any good to talk about how much money is exported from one part of the state to the other. That's a fact. That's where our wealth is. It does not do us any good for more conservative rural legislators to say we can't raise taxes. That's part of the solution. There are answers, and you have to try to get with it. I would like to posit this. Build your budget in this building with the money we have. Let's live within our means. That seems to be a really good idea. Build that budget. And then if you can live on it, pass it, and go home. Oregonians will live with what you do, and you will live with what you do. I don't think you can do that. You couldn't build a budget on the post-28 budget for the rest of this biennium. You build a budget that only gets $4.2 to $4.6 billion for schools, and I assume that means comparable for the other programs, you can't live with that budget. You're going to talk about revenues. You're going to have to talk about revenues. Then let's take Mr. Farioli's idea and let's talk about an initiative, not a local option. How about a 21st century school initiative? A SJR that established raises the limit, $2. And right along with it, a legislative measure that passes a $2 statewide tax for the 21st century initiative for schools. Raises $400 million or so a year. Fund all schools. And if you think that's too much, then go give them that $2 and go inside the Measure 5 and roll down the cap a little bit and create a local option there. But then every school district, every kid in Oregon gets a shot. Rather than the two, there won't be more than 6 to 8 districts pass a local option. And where are the rest of the kids in Oregon if that's what we have in the fall of this year? And the hurry to get this out is so we can vote this fall. Hey, if we vote on this June, or whatever you vote on, and you get in your caucuses and say, look, we are the board of directors for the entire state, and I know some of you don't want to raise taxes, but if you can't fund it at 4.2 or 4, if that doesn't do the job, you came here to do the job. And you can't get away. Once you vote, whether you vote yes or no on this, the decision, you all own the decision. Let's don't paint ourselves in the corner and say, we can't do anything long term, so we'll just do it short term. Excuse me.
Thank you, Ozzie.
Well put.
Ozzie, the only thing that comes to mind for me is, what track record of success do we have?
But what track record of success are we going to have? Have we have with local options?
Well, I mean, at least it allows local communities. I mean, you can look back 20 or 30 years, and I think there's been a lot of incredibly good people that have pounded their fists and actually made the same eloquent speech that you just made. And I'm ready to sign up for it. But you can also point to probably 100 who have sat in that chair and made that speech. And you can look at 20 to 25 initiatives that we have referred, and I can show you 25 statewide defeats. And so then the question is, do you allow local communities to have to live with those defeats? And if we were 1 for 25 or 2 for 25, but 0 for 25, I think that is the only thing that has to stick in all of our heads.
Let me go back. My scenario is this. My scenario is this. You're going to have to refer the measure, the constitutional measure. By the way, I don't think you're going to sunset. I don't think it's kind of goofy to put something in the Constitution and sunset it. I mean, the I don't go in there. But that's a different issue.
We had a sunset.
That's a vote either way. You got to do that no matter what we're talking about. My next step is, okay, I think when you people have to deal with a budget that only produces 4.2 or 4.6, you're going to have a very, very difficult time. Okay, now what do? You came here, 90 Republicans, 90 Democrats, 90 urban, 90 rural, 90 folks to do the business of the state. And you do it. And my choice right now is you levy a $2 and you levy it. You'd have the authority to do that. Now, it may get referred. If it got referred, 90 of you own that sucker. 90 of you are the campaign leaders in every district, your own district. You're running the state of Oregon. And it's better than standing here arguing over whether the wealth is moving from here to there and that kind of stuff. That isn't the issue. The issue is an adequate funding base for all, not just schools, for bridges, for hospitals, for everything else. And my frustration is when I come and talk to these individuals, we can't do anything because this group or that group won't. Get in those damn caucuses and do what you need to get done. Some of you are going to have to change positions that you've long taken. But it's the state of Oregon you're supposed to be working on. And we need a good school system in every town, not just those that can pass a local option.
Mr. Chair, does anybody have the sense that Ozzie's close to retirement?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Laurie, Tim, is Christy Feldsworth? She's still here.
I'm sorry. Chair, I passed that letter in for her. She never was.
Okay, so she's not here. So it's one more. Thank you very much. You're here to testify.
Mr. Chairman, I have the honor of serving on the Education Committee, which convened at 3 o'clock. And this is just the Revenue Committee. You ought to come on up to the Education Committee if you want to hear something.
I'm missing rules for this exciting session.
Thank you, Senator. Sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. And committee members, Lori Wimmer Whalen, for the record, with the Oregon Education Association representing 45,000 faculty at community colleges, educational support professionals at community colleges and K-12, and, of course, teachers. I feel a little schizophrenic right now because we are officially neutral on this, although I've got to tell you I echo everything that Ozzie Rose just said. And what I'm handing out to you is that local option history. Let me start right now with the viability of local option in Oregon. The mostly property wealthy districts who've tried to go out for it went out in the first couple elections. We've had 12 election cycles. 10 of them have had local option levies on the ballot. 50 districts have gone out. 16 have passed them. 14 of those 16 were right off the bat, and only two in all the years since. Now, there are a number of reasons that might be the case, but I think that one can look at the ones that succeeded, and they were the ones where the property wealth is in the state, and it's not hard to imagine that those that had the capacity to pass them, and some of them just barely squeaked by, even Portland, the so-called richest district, their turnout was 0.3% over the 50% for the double majority. They came very close to losing on a turnout basis. Calling this a shoe-in for districts wealthy or not might be overselling it, and I would our organization would ask for some data to be run out there before we race to this as even a partial solution. I'd hate to embrace something that delivers something of a hollow victory to the students of Oregon. We have some concerns about whether or not this really will, in these times, deliver the revenue that is so needed and hoped for. And that's not to say that we aren't grateful to each and every one of you for doing all that you have done and can do for K-12 funding and community college funding as well. It's just that we are a little bit, cynical about whether or not these will actually net a nickel for schools in the coming biennium. And to Ozzie's point about the base funding, I would rather see you discussing solutions to the structural problems of Oregon's tax system right now. And if there's a local argument, local option
argument to be had. Let's save that as a second step. It's March. It's not July. Sine die is not tomorrow. I'm not ready to give up on all of you. I'm not ready to give up on all of you. We could, if $2 per 1,000 assessed value is a good idea, then let's do it statewide. A statewide property tax is already in the Constitution. This would not have to go to the ballot. You could enact it in this building, show the courage, and raise over $800 million. And that would help the kid in Elgin, as well as the kid in Beaverton, as well as the kid in Eagle Point, and so on.
So, Lori, just on that point, you're talking to two senators who are probably sympathetic to some of
that. I know.
So what do you tell in terms of, you know this building pretty well, and you know vote counts, and you know track records of success. And, I mean, that would be my big question to you, is where can we point to, because I'm not willing to let a school district fall apart because this building can't act. And my faith in this building, and I think I have a great deal of data to back up that lack of faith in this building to provide a solution. But I'm really interested, what is the plan, and what is the data that shows this building actually could put something out and actually fix the overall state tax system?
Chair Deckard?
Mr. Chair, before she answers, I mean, I think a point you really need to understand is that you have to put all of those decisions in the context of the time that the question was asked. You know, I think that's really critical. And I think that the Democrats failed the state miserably during those five special sessions. I think that's part of what's got us here now. And I think if Democrats showed a little guts and showed a little strength and sat back and forced people into positions, I think Ozzie's exactly right. Remember the all-cuts budget in the third special session? The Republican caucuses couldn't tolerate that. Not the Democratic caucuses, the Republican caucuses. I don't think they can tolerate this low level of funding for social services or education. But I think we have to be patient enough and we have to be strong enough to force them to do the right thing.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say virtually the same thing, that it's a question of timing. And I agree with Ozzie that when the budget is eventually put together for K-12 and community colleges, every legislator in this building is going to take a look at it and respond to their emails and phone calls and letters, and they're not going to be able to pull the trigger. It is going to devastate Oregon, and everyone who looks at it with any sense at all is going to know that. And I don't believe that bumper sticker politics are going to rule the day in April the way they've ruled them in the past. I just can't believe that. I think we have good, decent people serving in this building, and they mean well, and I think that they're going to take a look at the facts and the data, and not hunches, facts and data, and they'll not be able to say no to the school children of Oregon, much less any of the other programs, by the way, that this doesn't even address. I know I'm here to lobby for schools, but I am also the chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition, and our coalition has been working on the very solutions that you're asking about. We're about to come forward with our proposals and solutions and suggestions, and we have a lot of suggestions that we think are very viable and that will deliver results and in terms of the dollars, and we're very confident that let's put things in the right order. Let's start going there first. Let's look at the budgets. Let's look at the revenue options, and then icing on the cake, pass out another tool for our tool bag. We would love to have it, but not instead of, let's have it as an in addition to, and time it to pass last.
Our problem is we have to be on the June ballot. I mean, that's our only dilemma with that.
Only if it's an instead of.
Well, if it's for next year, which is Tim.
Thank you, Chair Deckard, members of the committee, Tim Nesbitt, President of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I appreciate everybody's testimony today, especially those of the parents of school children. I myself am the parent of a Portland child who I call a Measure 5 kid because she started first grade the year after Measure 5 passed. Graduated from Grant High School last year, and every one of those years we saw the textbooks get older and out of date, class sizes grow larger, and programs being cut. And professionally, I've been in the forefront of a movement to try and change Measure 5 since an abortive effort in 1992 called Measure 7. Been working on it every year since. And now, in my current capacity, I have shared with our labor movement a long history of bringing issues to the ballot, of fighting issues on the ballot. And so I want to share some of my perspectives with you about what's winnable. I have to say that... at best, we would be neutral on this measure, respectfully neutral, respectful of the effort, respectful of the idea of a local option. But we would, and I've consulted with our unions, our major public unions, AFSCME and SEIU, would be unlikely to step forward and play any major role in support. And that's because, as you heard from so much of the prior testimony, this is nobody's first choice. Even Jim Scherzinger said the same thing, that this is not his first choice or the Portland School Board's first choice. So I think we should be addressing what are the better choices before we abandon them and say this is the only thing that will work. And, of course, those criteria include what's fair and adequate and stable funding for schools, but also what's winnable, what we think the voters are likely to support. The problems we face now are that if you look at the data, working people are paying a greater portion of their income now in taxes as a percent of personal income than ever before, even back in 1990 before Measure 5 passed. That is an obstacle. Even though we now have the lowest business tax rates of any of the 11 Western states, we continue to hear the pushback from the business community about the impact on business if we raise taxes. Now, the more we've been thinking about this, and actually our thinking is changing as we work on this issue this session, and I've worked on it many times before, the more we think that the arguments from the business community probably have the greatest relevance to the property tax, because that's a tax that's paid whether or not you're profitable. And if you look instead at the income tax, corporate income tax, personal income tax, because both are paid depending on whether you're a C-corp or an S-corp or small business, there you only pay the tax if you're profitable. So if we're in hard times, it makes sense to us that a more viable tax option is one that wouldn't overly penalize businesses but would tax businesses, restore some business tax effort, because don't get me wrong, I think that's a key here. It's restoring some business tax effort to our tax system, but should be done in a way that works with the same principle that works for individual taxpayers, and that's ability to pay. I think one of the dilemmas we've had over the last dozen years or so is that in good times, and when Measure 47 passed, those were comparatively good times, and eventually, you know, those revenue forecasts were rolling in, and you kept seeing more money, and suddenly the problem was solved. People were more likely to say business should pay their fair share because they were less concerned about job losses. In bad times, when the case for revenue is most compelling, the discomfort about perhaps seeing job losses when you tax a business more rises. So you have these offsetting factors, and those especially come into play, I think, in regard to the property tax. We think there are better options, options that are more fair, more adequate, and more stable. And stability includes not just economic stability, but political stability, and more winnable on the ballot. We think we should be looking more at the income tax. You'll be seeing data next week in some of the reports that Lori referred to that shows that for every dollar we levy in income taxes in the state of Oregon, corporate and personal combined, we collect 55 cents. Now, the other 45 cents goes back in the form of tax credits and exclusions and exemptions, some of them for very good things, making health care more affordable, helping seniors make ends meet, helping workers save for retirement, but a lot of them for a lot more questionable purposes. And many of them don't appear to us to be very cost-effective. If you were to say, we're going to squeeze down those tax exemptions, which are a big part of your budget, that's the flip side of the budget, the tax expenditures, we're going to squeeze them down to, let's say, 33 cents on the dollar. Yeah. So for every $2 we collect in income taxes, we'll let $1 go back to all those good purposes, helping seniors, helping homeowners afford their homes. You would raise $2.1 billion in the next biennium. Pretty big number. That's staying with the income tax. That's staying with the ability to pay for individuals and for businesses. If that doesn't work, we've been saying for years that an equity issue between businesses and individuals and between large corporations and S corporations and partnerships, which are mostly the small businesses, equalize the corporate income tax so businesses pay the same tax on their profits that workers pay on their wages and that a small business pays on its taxable income. That'll raise over $200 million in the next biennium. But if I'm wrong about the viability of the income tax proposals and you have to look at a property tax, then please look at something that extends its benefits to more than just schools. Schools are important, but I think the Measure 28 campaign taught us that so are human services and so are public safety. Perhaps you can do something statewide that exempts or gives a better deal to owner-occupied homes, so you're not putting extra pressure on the homeowner, especially outside the metro area where I think you'll run into the greatest resistance. And if you have to do a statewide property tax, if you have to do one statewide, use your statutory authority and look critically at property tax exemptions at that point, because I think you've heard the figure of $2 on a statewide property tax raising $800 million. It would raise $1.3 billion or more if you just said, and there shall be no exemptions. No exemptions. Now, you can make one big exception to the exemptions, and that is we wouldn't propose taxing stocks and bonds, which show up in the tax expenditure report as intangible property. That's a big number. No, that's a whole different tax system. But otherwise, no exemptions. $1.3 billion on $2. And I would want to respectfully disagree with some of the prior testimony. I don't think a sales tax is more stable. Look what California is going through right now. Every bit as severe a budget problem as we have. They got the proverbial third leg of the stool with a sales tax. It's not necessarily more more stable. In this environment, we've had pretty strong consumer spending up till now, which you'd think would hold up the sales tax base, but we've had reduced business spending, and businesses pay about 40% of the sales tax, so that's what's taking the hit. Not necessarily more stable. But back to the final criterion, you know, what's winnable? We're not sure this measure could pass. What Measure 28 taught us is it's about more than just schools. What it also taught us is that it needs whatever measure we take to the ballot needs to be better designed to reflect the understanding of the real tax burdens in our tax system, including those on working families and those on a small business as well. And finally, on the debate, the continuing debate today about would this advance, be neutral, or retard progress towards a statewide solution, I have to weigh in on the side of retard. And that's because once you have a new tax system added, the tax you know is always a little more comfortable than the tax you don't yet have and the tax you don't yet know. And I just think that if we pass this, voters would be that much more resistant to coming back and approving anything else. Thank you.
Don?
Mr. Chair? One quick question. Jim, if you looked at the, I've looked at the tax expenditure on the mortgage interest, and that's been one of the ones, I mean, it's huge. It's like $454 million a biennium or something. Have you looked at possibly putting an adjusted gross income? I see Lori nodding her head. An adjusted gross income, as opposed to saying mortgage on second homes, because if it's just mortgage on second homes, people will be smart enough to switch their financing over to their first mortgage, and finance their second home on their home they're living in.
Chair Deckard, Senator Corcoran, I'm not sure that's the best approach. I understand the problem. I think the better approach might be to say you will just put a cap on the amount of interest payments you can deduct, and it's something like $20,000. That's basically saying, okay, on the first $300,000 a year of your mortgage, you can deduct that. Above that, you can't. And I think the numbers then show about $50 million is what you'd achieve. Because basically, if you look at the two tax breaks we give to help people own and stay in their homes, which are good purposes. We allow them to write off mortgage interest costs, and we allow them to write off property taxes that they pay off of their income tax base. And about half the taxpayers file the long form and take advantage of that. Those are good purposes, but because we also extend that to second homes, as do the feds, we just follow the federal tax code on that, and we have no reasonable upper limit. I think there's $1 million upper limit on a refinance, but that hardly ever comes into play. Basically, we're giving more housing assistance to owners of mansions and to the wealthy than we are to the average working family, and I don't think that makes sense. So I think something can be adjusted there.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg with Oregon Farm Bureau. I don't want to carry this too far, but I'd have to say that I would agree with probably 85-95% of what my new friend, Mr. Nesbitt, just said.
He'll help you on the farm worker stuff.
Well, we'll cross that bridge when we get there, Senator Corcoran. Thank you. But we wholeheartedly agree, and I've heard most of the testimony here today, that local control is crucial to this issue, to public support for the taxes that people pay. A second principle that helps the taxpayers have a comfortable level for the taxes that they pay is the payment of a tax that is relevant to the services they receive. Suppose we tried financing the state legislature with a property tax. How long do you think we would have a legislature? There's no relevancy there between the tax you pay and the service you receive. And that philosophy is the basis for the policy adopted by the Farm Bureau members, and this has been in place for 8 to 10 years already, that says property taxes for property services and a tax based on ability to pay for social services. At least for the long haul, this bill would seem to go against that philosophy. Schools are a social service, not a property tax, not a property service. Therefore, they are most appropriately funded by a tax based on one's ability to pay. Whether that's income tax or sales tax really doesn't make any difference. You can design one to be as fair as the other, so that's really immaterial. We believe that leads us to a position of a combination of state funding for equalization, a local option based on taxpayers' ability to pay.
So you would support a income tax local option?
I didn't say that, Mr. Chairman. but yes, Mr. Chairman, I think you could come to that conclusion very easily.
The Farm Bureau would. The Farm Bureau would support some sort of local option based on income taxes for schools.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, how we get there, how you put that together, I'm not sure. I think local control, state equalization, and a tax based on ability to pay are sound tax philosophies. This bill, as it is, represents a tax increase. Saving grace of that, of course, is it's up to people to vote on whether or not they want to do it. But nonetheless, it does represent a tax increase, which is hard for a lot of people to swallow, as you've heard here today. On the other hand, you've also heard, and I think correctly so, that because of Measure 5, we've had some tax decrease. So maybe there is some room for some tax increase. But I'll conclude my testimony with that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it. Lori, yeah.
I forgot to tell you one thing about this. It's a technical point, but I want it on the record. Ozzy alluded to it very quickly, but I just wanted to make sure that everyone was aware of this piece. Because of the local option equalization grants, assuming that they would control for this new turbocharged local option as well, the way that's working is that it's funded by scooping it off the top of the state school fund, which thereby diminishes the allocation to all of the Oregon's 198 school districts to fund the local option equalization grant pot. Now, that means that those schools that are below the line in property wealth who pass a local option have access to the matching money. But those who never could pass it, meaning the poorest by measure of property wealth, districts would be sacrificing their state school fund dollars in order to subsidize the local option equalization pot for wealthier districts that were able to pass it. And that's a structural issue that while we support the local option equalization, as indeed we wrote the original language on that, we were conceiving of better economic times, not these financially desperate times in which we're taking out of one pocket and putting it into another. And I think that that's an important point for the record, to note that it's something that's of concern to us in this whole debate.
Yeah, and I should note, Lori, I think I did in the introduction, that this is truly a work in progress. We're going to meet tomorrow with council, a group of us, and actually start hashing out probably a whole new set of amendments on this bill. And so at least you should know that to at least keep your eyes open, as you always do anyhow. And I think you'll see a whole new set. But you at least know the parameters, at least where we're going or would like to go. Because I think the vehicle and the parameters are going to stay the same, but we're certainly going to work out a lot of the details in the next couple of days. Don?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, not trying to do a conversation here, but also would like to add, in spite of my new friend, Mr. Nesbitt, we would disagree on the statewide property tax. We do have policy that opposes a statewide property tax, and that would, of course, be inconsistent with our tax philosophy of property-related services for property taxes for those services and not for social services.
Mr. Chair, addressing my newfound friend, well, it's interesting to know we may disagree on our second choice. I'm hearing us agreeing on our first choice, income tax.
So noted. I wrote it down. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Andrea, do you want to come on up? You just got me now and Steve. And is Scott Bailey? Scott, are you here or did you take off? Bill Perry, you want to weigh in on this? Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Andrea Henderson, Oregon Community College Association. And I wanted just to take a moment to talk a little bit about this bill and its impact on community colleges. And we've heard a lot today about how this creates funding for K-12, and also wanted to talk about this is also a benefit to community colleges as well. Currently, community colleges receive 23% of their funding from local property taxes. And similar to K-12, prior to the passage of Measure 5, our major source of funding was a local property tax. As you know, community colleges, because they now receive a large portion of their funding from the general fund, really are hurting financially. They haven't had the kind of general fund obligations that would actually help the community college services. Right now, with the governor's proposed budget, community college funding is just slightly above the 97-99 levels, yes. Which, with the increase in enrollment that we've had and the many Oregonians that are turning to community colleges because they've been laid off, makes it very difficult for us to provide services that are going to give people training to get back to work. So I did want to really highlight the fact that some type of legislation along these lines does impact community colleges and does help our funding situation. And also wanted to let you know that as you are looking at ways to deal with the equalization issue, with community colleges, it's not the same set of issues and problems that you have with K-12, that our formula is different than the K-12 formula. I would encourage you to craft solutions that deal with K-12 and community colleges each according to how they're impacted by the property taxes. With that, I would just like to encourage you in your work in this and be happy to answer any questions or provide information as you go forth.
Thank you. Sorry that you had to go last. It's a tough brawl. But we'll definitely keep you guys in touch with you as we move forward. I think especially given how you guys came out in the governor's first budget, mm-hmm. and now with as the revenue forecast continues to go down, I think this is just going to be all the more important because community colleges were the ones that probably had the toughest time just coming out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to find some solution. I think you guys will look for local solutions if you can't, if this funding situation continues.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Anyone else? Great. We are adjourned.